What's up and welcome to episode one of the NYC Video Podcast, a show that explores what it's like to live and work in NYC in the film and video industry. I'll be your host, Tom Chavez, and for today's episode, I caught up with Whitney Conway. He's a great comedic and commercial director here in New York. I've had the pleasure of working with Whit for about 4 or 5 years and counting, and he's just a great guy to work with. He writes, he directs, he produces, he even edits a lot of the content that he produces. You can see a lot of his work in commercials. You can see a lot of his work on TV shows like SNL, and he also produces a lot of his own sketch comedy work that he works with a variety of different comedic actors here in New York. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to this podcast and check out our social media or website if you want to learn more about the guests on the show, or you can also learn about some of the resources that NYC has to offer us filmmakers here in New York. So without further ado, here's today's interview with Whit Conway. All right, cool, man. So from what I found online, I saw that you went to the University of Indiana.
There's like a telecom program that I studied and fell sort of backwards into the production program at IU, which is in the telecom school there. It was good, but it wasn't great. I think like it's not a traditional film program. It's more of a broadcast program. But while I was there, there was like a sketch comedy class that I took in my final year called SCAP, which was like you develop your own material and sort of, you know, it's like a mini Saturday Night Live, sort of like an introduction into like, hey, you generate material and you shoot stuff every week. And everybody rotates through all the different positions from like production design through like gaffing and sure. and everything. So so that was sort of my first foray into a bigger production.
So when you left school, like, I guess, were you like a film major?
Yes, film major. Yeah, film major. And then went back to Chicago and started working in post-production and then production in Chicago. But it, you know, it's a much different market. And so, yeah, I think the, I don't know. Do you have a question about that, right?
So like, you know, like I went to film school as well. And right. like, you know, when I got out of film school, I was already here in New York, but what was it like, I guess, finding work once you got out of film school and you were in Chicago?
So I graduated in 2006-07. And so going back to Chicago, it was a very different, I think it was a bit of a different time because there was a lot of these old, you know, I say old, I mean, it's pre like DSLR shooting. I was working at a post house called Optimus as like an intern. I really loved it. There they do like high-end commercials, and it was like, hey, this is how people actually do stuff, you know, in the post-production world. And then I decided that I didn't want to only do post, that I really wanted to like, I had my mind on like producing, which I think really what I look back on it is it's really I just wanted to direct stuff, but I didn't maybe have the balls to say that to myself. And then left there and started working at a different company in Chicago that was doing production work. But, you know, this was for like Sprint cell phones before the iPhone came out. Okay. So Sprint TV was the first like full production job I had. And that was like a, you know, really, really small team making daily content for Sprint cell phones pre iPhone. So like you're streaming on like, you know, 2G data. So all that to say, I think like Chicago, it's a much different market. And I think if you don't have a full-time gig, to me at least, when I was that young, I just had no idea how to work the industry there. I think that if you're more established, it might feel a little more friendly to you, but it didn't feel like, you know, like Dark Knight was shooting when I was there, and I like did everything to try and get to be a PA on that, and I couldn't get my resume in the right hands of people that could make that happen. And so I was like, okay, well, I've got to make some money somehow. And I really didn't want to like become a bartender, which I did try my hand at for a little bit, but sure. Very poorly. I really wanted to try and stick to, you know, working in the industry. And so I, you know, there are plenty of production houses in Chicago. They're mostly advertising focused. You know, I wonder what it's like now, but it feels like it's splintered into like lots of small post and production houses. I think that I had a different experience of like feeling like I needed a staff job, you know, feeling like, oh, I need insurance and I need a regular paycheck and I can't really survive on Chicago freelance because there's just not as much, or at least not as much to someone that didn't have a network of connections.
Before you mentioned like the whole DSLR boom, once that kind of like took off with like the, you know, the Canon Mark II, everyone was kind of shooting on these like DSLR shoulder rigs and stuff like that. Did you ever see any kind of boom in production in Chicago, I guess, when that happened, or how did that?
Yeah. I was taking class at Second City and doing stuff in like the improv community and the comedy community there. And that's where I saw that. I really saw that, like, people, oh, okay, they're making their own. I'm shooting a whole movie on a DSLR. And so I actually split a DSLR with a buddy of mine and started to be able to be like a guy that could go, hey, I can shoot this for you. You know, but I didn't have many skills in terms of like actually practically like using a camera, which is an interesting thing. I just ended up teaching myself the whole thing based around the DSLR sort of ecosystem, and then sort of slowly, step by step, upping my game and upping my gear and just challenging myself to do different types of shooting and trying to learn as much as I can. So like I saw that in the community. I did see that in the production. I was working at a corporate agency, and there was they were working on like EX1s, which were like old mini DV tapes, and then they're like Sony, like the P2 card cameras, but those are very like prosumer, full body, like take two XLR inputs and, yeah, and not, you know, the smaller chip and everything like that. So the company I was working at, they did sort of like embrace, hey, okay, we can get a cool look and, we'll get, you know, some fast lenses and make our look more cinematic. And I think that was the beginning of, you know, that was like 2008 to 2009 when it just felt like everything was sort of transitioning towards that, sure, model.
And were you like with that kind of content, were you like directing it, shooting and running sound, doing a little bit of everything? Or
the crash of 2009 canceled that Sprint TV contract. Wow. And so like 70 people lost their jobs at this company that I was working at. And I ended up falling into this company that was a corporate agency. It was a lot of people who grew up doing their own thing. And so they didn't understand the any sort of traditional way of doing it. They created the company themselves. And so because they did, I think they did a lot of things wrong, but they also, you know, had really small teams. And that at that age for me allowed me to be like, okay, I have people skills and I can work with a client. And I was hired as a producer. They had like, you know, they had cinematographers on staff and they had motion graphics guys and editors on staff. And I just ended up starting to fall back into like, well, I can get my hands dirty in this and sort of teach myself how to do this and teach myself how to do that. And, you know, since we're only five people going out on a shoot, really try and understand how the camera's working. And then it was really like tons and tons of interviews. Like, we would go to these pharmaceutical companies in Chicago with not much scheduling and planning and basically just have a slate of interviews of like, we got to interview 20 people today, wow, you know, wow, and just cycle people through. For me, that helped me understand, I at least know how to make people sort of feel comfortable in front of the camera that might not be comfortable, and then try and like feign the interest that you need to get someone who might not be comfortable on camera to tell you a compelling story, which at these, I think many of these gigs were not that compelling. They were, you know, it was corporate content selling, sure, pharmaceutical stuff. But ultimately, it was a lot of hands-on and a really good sort of second school for me, I think, like, but practical, like, how are you budgeting? How stuff that I was in charge of because the company was so small. And then I got to have my hands on everything. And then that sort of crossed over into the work that I was doing at Second City, which was my fun work. I would go to work and then I would intern at Second City and then I would take class at Second City and then, you know, and then be doing shows as well with random groups of friends in that community. And invariably, like, you know, the company I was working for started letting me borrow equipment. And this is before I bought my first DSLR. So I was like borrowing a lot of their lights and, you know, without any understanding of how to light properly, sure. Just like, hey, you can use these Kinos. That sort of transitioned myself into like, okay, I can be the guy in our improv community that has access to gear, sort of ready access to gear that I can shoot stuff at any time.
Sure.
And I think that lended itself just to like, oh, you know, I did a couple videos, a couple people saw those and they asked me to, you know, work with them on another video. And that was really the beginning of where I started making my own stuff.
Cool. And just real quick, you mentioned Second City a couple times. What is Second City exactly?
Second City is the comedy school, the comedy theater and improv school that you know, John Candy and I mean, like, you know, Dan Aykroyd, John Belushi and Chris Farley and Tim Meadows and Tina Fey and Adam McKay and, you know, that whole crew, Amy Sedaris. Amy Poehler, you know, like the UCB crew. There was there's two schools of comedy in Chicago, Improv Olympic or IO, and Second City. And those are the sort of the two most popular. There's another one called The Annoyance. And then there's a bunch of other splinter ones that teach improv comedy. And so when I got out of college, I started doing that at, when I was working at that post house, right out of school, I was sort of interested in a friend there was taking a class and they were like, I think you'd really enjoy this. And I went and I did, you know, I fell in love with the community of it, but really just, I like entertainment and I wanted to work in that capacity, you know, and then had to work in corporate production as a day job.
Sure.
So, and then that was sort of the meshing of those two worlds was my first foray into, you know, what I might say like filmmaking.
Sure. That's cool. So like, it kind of like fed your passion and it was kind of like, yeah, like a night school for you to kind of like learn and get involved in the community. And
absolutely. I mean, I think it's interesting for me to look back because I go, oh man, I still feel not green, but I feel like at the beginning part of that in my career, I feel like I think what Second City taught me was there's just so many possibilities in that, like, comedy is so many different things. And it was a really safe community for trying stuff. And so even when you're failing, there's a lot of people going, that was really great. That encouragement goes a long way. I think it's different. It's a little different in New York and LA from what I've heard about LA. And then also just doing stuff in New York. I think it is a little different. I think because it's closer to the industry, it feels like there are greater stakes for some of that work in places like New York and Los Angeles.
So from what I saw, you left Chicago around 2014, 2015, is that right?
2015. So my wife and I think Chicago had been sort of saying like, go, you should go, you should get out of here, you know, please leave. and I grew up there and I loved it. And I really didn't want to move to New York. I never liked New York when I was a kid. But my wife, I met a Jersey girl and then we got married and had a baby. And then when we got home from the hospital, my landlord, you know, met the baby the day that we got him home. We're on our first walk with my son, who's 4 days old. And he's like, hey, nice to meet you. You know, by the way, we're going to do this project where we rip the front of the building off in like 6 weeks. So you can totally stay in your apartment. We'll just build a plastic wall to the elements outside. This is in March in Chicago. Which is like, you know, you don't want an open front of your apartment with a plastic wall with a fucking infant, pardon my language. So we went upstairs. We were like, okay, we'll stay. We'll stick around. And then we went upstairs and called our parents and they were like, just move back in with us. Sure. And she lives on the shore or she grew up on the shore in New Jersey, which is where we live now. We having the baby and then moving was, you know, it was like a big rip the bandaid off. My wife also graduated from Northwestern's business school. So she literally handed in the last final and then went into labor that night.
Wow.
So we did the like trifecta of we both found new jobs, had a baby, moved across the country. We did all those things within a matter of about 5 weeks. And ultimately, you know, when I got to New York, it was one of those things where like when I was in Chicago, I had jumped around to a couple different agencies, but I had been doing a lot more comedy stuff. And when I got to New York, a bunch of people in Chicago sort of reached out to the people they knew in New York. And because I had said, hey, I'm moving, you know, they were like, I'm going to reach out to my network and we'll see if you can get you some meetings. And it was really supportive. It was a really wonderful move. When I think people in New York, this is the way I interpreted it. People in New York are used to asking for help and like sort of networking in a way that I think people in the Midwest maybe feel like is a little over the line or like a little too forward. But in New York, it's just so commonplace that like, if you're hungry enough to ask, people think that's a good thing. And so that they're sort of like willing to help. Sure. And then I remember one of the guys, like I got hooked up with a guy who ran the show Bloodline. which was my first big meeting that I ever had with anyone in entertainment. And he was like, look, I've been where you are. Like, I always want to help people because I asked for help one time. And that one time, I think he was, you know, he was saying at the beginning of my career, I reached out to people and I was helped in the way that I'm trying to help you. And so, and that was a really, it was a really honestly like a heartwarming experience, because when I got to New York, I had jobs coming at me because I had a decent reel of work. And then every single one of those meetings, I either got connected to someone else that eventually gave me a job, or they, you know, if they had a job for me, they gave it to me. It was literally like almost 100% of the meetings that I ended up having. Yeah. Were fruitful, which was surprising, especially after Chicago, where like I had tons of those meetings in Chicago. There's just not as much work. And so I think there just wasn't as much opportunity. And so even if they, you know, like they just didn't have that kind of a slate of work to offer. And so when you have those meetings, it's like, yeah, I'll let you know. And then, you know, sure enough, they forget. Where in New York, it was great. I need you. Are you available this week? You know?
Sure. So when you got to New York, were you like freelancing kind of thing, like off the bat, or did you interview for these positions like at an in-house agency or?
Yeah, I've been freelance since I got to New York. And that's led to like, because at that agency that I mentioned earlier, that corporate agency, I started doing camera work and producing and directing and doing my own editing and then doing motion graphics. And then that also lended itself to all the work I was doing in comedy was the same. So I would sort of try to do something. And then I had friends I could reach out to in my motion graphics, you know, like my motion graphics buddies who would be like, oh yeah, you're trying to do this. Let me actually show you the right way to do this. But ultimately I was using a lot of those skills in the corporate and then also the comedy side. And so when I got to New York, I was doing the same thing. I was working on the corporate side or the brand film, I guess it really started to turn into that. It was like the beginning of like, yeah, branded content. And there was just a litany of opportunity. And then the comedy stuff, it just happened to help that I could do more, you know. When I got here, I think it there was some work maybe 6 months or so after I got here that was like Comedy Central and IFC stuff that was paid, but it took a little bit of time to get sort of that stuff going. And frankly, it was the first time I had ever been paid to do comedy work, which was great.
Definitely a milestone in someone's career where you get to actually get paid to do what you want to do.
Do the thing you want to do. Yeah.
Cool. So exactly right. Would you say like that, I guess the fact that you direct, that you produce, that you write, that you edit, would you say like that really, like those skills basically all helped you get work faster here in New York and just meet people and be able to accomplish more work?
I think it helps. I mean, it's tough because, you know, I want to say I'm a specialist, but really I am, you know, but I also do other things. And so I think for my brand stuff, it was, and it's funny because some of the people I met with were like, great, you seem like you'd be a good producer. And I was like, yes, I produce. And then they hire me as a producer, but then they only see me as a producer. They hire me as a DP and they only see me as a DP, or the same goes for editing. So occasionally those lines blur, I think, when things are needed. Generally when there's like a thing, I think that when there's a high pressure project that, you know, something needs to be done fast and I can offer like, hey, I can do that. I was just on a shoot for The Late Show because I DP over there for a great producer, my friend Jake Plunkett. And we were shooting something and he was like, yeah, I'd love this shot, a character standing in front of a moving sign and they were going to replace the words on the sign. He said, I love it, but I don't have time to rotoscope it. And I was like, I can do that. You know, I can do this comp for you tomorrow. And he's like, great, you know, let's do that. And so I think like, you know, that's the first time I've ever worked in post for The Late Show, but it just came out of being there in the moment, being like, you know, this is the shot. It's a better shot for the piece. And also, you know, it's an executable VFX comp if you want it to be.
Cool. Yeah. I mean, I've always like found that, the best directors that I work with, like they have like a really good understanding of not just directing and talking with actors, but also talking lighting. Like if a cinematographer is busy doing something else, the I can have a conversation with the director when he or she can tell me like, this is the mood we're going for. Like maybe we can try to use this kind of light or they just kind of speak the lingo of many different departments, which I think to me makes a much better director because they can communicate, which is the main tool I think a director has. Has that helped you out on like just the different juice that you've worked with?
Yeah. I think that was well said. I think that should, to me, that is what a director is, you know, that's their job. They hold the thing in their mind that they want and they work with whatever they have. So to me, that's everything from, hey, we don't have any budget, but we got to make this happen. The director's got to know how to make, you know, how to get what he wants out of the department that he's working with. Or from coming from a comedy world perspective, or just even just like a DIY perspective, like a solo filmmaker perspective, it doesn't have to be comedy or anything. I think you know what you need. Hopefully, you know what you need for the piece. You know what you can lose from the piece and still make a piece. Whatever you're doing, I think that if you have the experience of like, I've got to sacrifice something, you know,
sure,
because I don't have a drone and so I can't get that shot that I would love, or I don't have an art department, so I've got to make it up, or I've got to hide my location so that's not super apparent, or shoot really tight so that I can, you know, sort of shoot around the aspect that we're not spending money in that way, or whatever it is. I think that hopefully, yes, the communication to other departments, but also the understanding of like what's most important about the piece that you're doing and it, for the budget that you're doing it. I think in doing a lot of learning about how filmmakers approach things, I don't know if you like MasterClass. I'm a huge fan of MasterClass.
I just signed up during coronavirus. I had a lot of free time.
I'm a big fan, so let's get you sponsored by MasterClass. I really like it because it's like the most inspirational content that I can consume, and it's long. And so like if I'm animating something, or if I'm, you know, sifting through like hours and hours of B-roll for any project, I tend to keep something on the side of my screen so that I don't go on the internet, which is me admitting that I'm a procrastinator. But I was just watching Spike Lee's, and he was just talking about, you know, budgeting and saying like, look, there's going to be some time that like you have to sacrifice something. You can't, unless you're at the very, very top of whatever game. And even then, you know, like Spike Lee is still going, I've got to make it happen for a certain amount of money. And I've got, and that's still a lot of pressure to make it the most efficient piece. As tried to treat that into my DIY sort of self producing and self filmmaking abilities. I've tried to embody that approach where I can go, I can do this for whatever we're working on, whether that's we're self funding it to the tune of $5,000 to $10,000 and we're going to actually spend money on some stuff, or it's just me and friends and we're going to go out and make it happen with no money and for as little money as possible. And we're, you know, just pay for meals for people and parking, sure. You know?
And I guess, so I know that you were doing like a lot of improv back in Chicago. And when you came to New York, did you know anyone here in that improv comedy world, or did you kind of like build like a new kind of crew? And cause I've noticed that on a lot of your films, you work with a lot of the same actors and comedic actors, which I believe are probably from your improv circles.
Yeah.
How did that play out?
A lot of those people I met in Chicago, but they, I'm sorry, I met in New York, but they were in Chicago. And then a solid handful of them, there's been plenty of people that have come and gone from Chicago. And so I, you know, there's definitely been some crossover from the people that I used to work with and make stuff with in Chicago to working with them in New York. But a lot of them, I sort of met through friends in Chicago when I got to New York. And even a lot of them was like, I was maybe introduced to them in like when I got here, but then it took a little while to work with them, or I was a fan of theirs and I ended up on a shoot with them. And then we ended up doing something together.
Yeah.
And I think, cause anytime anyone asked me to sort of chat in this way, the only reason I think that happened is cause I try and be the best partner that I can be in whatever capacity. I think that thing, like I like the making of the pudding, you know? Mm-hmm. So I like how everything is being set up from a logistical standpoint and a budgeting standpoint, but we're also working on set. And I just try and be as, when I got here and when I was sort of like, hey, you're just the DP, you're just the editor. I'm curious about the other aspects of it. And I was curious, and I think I was eager to, which I know, you know, some people might be like, we don't need the DP's opinion on this, but I think that ultimately I think it was my eagerness and my attitude that helps to like garner relationships with people to go like, hey, Whit works hard. He's not a complainer. He's, you know, I've had plenty of ACs be like, you don't have to help us clean up at the end of the night, you know, when I'm DPing. And I'm like, no, like all I've heard is like, why would I just leave unless I had to, you know, unless there was something that was calling me away that was more important. Or if, you know, if you're on a longer shoot and you're advancing another location or something like that, or you got to go to meetings and stuff like that, you know, but if I can, I'm going to do my best to be able to be the most helpful person that I can, because I've been the guy coiling cable at the end of the night at 3 a.m. And if you just have one extra set of hands, it's helpful.
Trust me, but having been a person who's worked with you before, that's one thing that I totally admire about you and others like you. At the end of the day, instead of just dropping a wrench and going home and getting your car or a train, just taking the extra few minutes and just helping out your crew to, you know, pack up some cases or, you know, schlep some C-stands or sandbags and stuff like that. It's always appreciated. And that's one of the things that I do really admire about you. And one of the reasons I love working with you is because you're very selfless and you do look out for other people. So.
Well, I love working with you, Tom. Thank you for that. I mean, I think that to me is, it's just, who do you want to work with?
Yeah.
Do you want to work with the guy that is, well, there's, to me, there's two facets of it. Like, I want people to go, I had a good time working with Whit. And maybe that's the people pleasing aspect of my personality. It absolutely could be. But I also think, like, you know, there's a reason that I get hired for work, and a lot of that is a crew, you know, that, so I want to make it as easy on my crews as I can, because, you know, when I hire you, Tom, I know that I can count on you to make it look as good as it can look, you know, and with whatever we have, like I said earlier, you know, with whatever restrictions that we have on our time and our budget. But to me, it's being a good partner and a leader of your crew. And I worked in a kitchen in college and I washed dishes, for months. Yeah. And you just, like, you know, the guys that were like given a restaurant or, you know, never worked in the kitchen. And then, you know, the people that have done the job that you did. And I think that for me, there's a big part of me that's really trying to hang on to, I hope for the rest of my life, the idea that I washed dishes, you know, and that I know what it feels like to wash dishes. And that if you can help out in any way to the people that are doing that for you, then they'll really, that's an example to them of how to be a leader. Absolutely. of a whatever it is, of a film, of a, you know, restaurant, whatever.
Yeah.
And also, like, just restaurant.
Being on set also for like 12, 13, 14 hours on some days, it's just like, you want to work with people that you like to work with, that, you know, that are caring, that are, you know, sympathetic and stuff like that. There's nothing worse than being stuck on a long shoot with a tyrant or someone that you just hate working with.
Yes.
So it definitely goes a long way, and it helps build community, and it's definitely gotten me work. Like, you know, just having helped out other crew members, you know, they either recommend me for other jobs because they know they can count on me, not just for one specific thing that I do for money, but also just as a team player. And it definitely plays into a lot of what we do.
I think that's right. I think when I was, you know, to take it back to like some of those early lessons that I learned when I was working at that post house that did commercials in Chicago right out of college, this guy, Ruben Vella, he's a great editor and he was an assistant editor at the time. He was nice enough to sort of like take me as an intern and be like, I'll show you how I'm working in After Effects. This is like, I had no understanding of what After Effects could even do other than it looked foreign to me. Mm-hmm. And he was willing to let me sit next to him and watch him for hours. When I was talking to him, one of the first things he ever said to me, he said, "Well, it doesn't matter if the guy who's hiring you or girl who's hiring you, they think you can do the job better than the next person. It matters if they want to hang out with you for 18 hours a day."
Exactly.
For weeks on end. And so that to me is knowing, and this is what he said to me, and I sort of like to pass it along because this is really valuable for me, or that I really took to heart. He said, that's knowing, you know, how to be in a room. And he was talking about being in an editing room, which if you've ever been in an edit room, sometimes it's not your place to speak. And there's, you know, sometimes your opinion isn't needed. Sometimes you have to blend into the background, you know, and even as a main editor, sometimes that's not your fight to have with the writers and directors in the room. It's maybe their job to hash that out. And your job is to present them with the options. And that's something that I've kept in mind my whole career. It really stuck with me that like, it's about being a good, because you're exactly right. You don't want to be on set with a tyrant. You don't want to work in any capacity with someone who's going to treat you poorly or treat other people poorly. Like even if they're never comfortable to be the guy who's like next to the guy who's treating someone like shit, you know?
Yeah, of course.
And you've got to stand there and keep your mouth shut because they're employing you.
Well, yeah. You know, now that we're on the kind of topic of relationships and maintaining kind of strong relationships, I know that you mentioned that you were married in Chicago prior to coming here and that you moved to New York with a child.
Yes, I did.
What was it like working as a freelance filmmaker and coming to New York without necessarily a definitive job and being married with a child? Because I know I recently had kids and it scared the hell out of me. Yeah. It was a process. So I want to hear what was your process like? What was it like?
The older that, I don't know. I think like your relationships are the relationships you have outside of work to me are the most, they're the most important. They also like, they allow me to have my career. I've looked at that. Like if I didn't have my wife, I don't think I would have the career I had because she's just been really, really supportive and allowed me even with children to be like, yes, I think you should do this. I think this would be good for you, but it would also be good for us, you know? And I think that we tend to look at our life together as, because she's much smarter than I am. She did a lot more school than I did and is just a really determined and successful person and is someone who, that was part of what attracted me to her, but also she's the type of person who, you know, I knew was just going to have a great career and she has. And I think that that's something that she has, there have been times when we've leaned on each other and this is before kids even, you know, times when I was out of work and we were leaning on her salary, the times when she was out of work and we were leaning on mine. And then the other metaphorical leaning ons when it's just like, hey, we both need extra help, you know, at times trying to survive in this world. And so, yeah, I think that having the strength of a relationship like that, like it can help you. I think, especially if you're making stuff, it can help you get out of your head and be like a little bit of a, even if it's a biased opinion, but just biased encouragement, it can be really helpful at times in terms of the, like being able to do freelance stuff. Yeah. Like with her, she carries our insurance, you know, she makes enough money that if I don't work for 3 months that we're okay. Her sure. parents help us with our kids, which I know, you know, just incredibly vital to being. Yeah, it's vital. I mean, there was an opportunity that I had right before coronavirus to possibly move to LA. And it was a huge weight on me, trying to think about whether or not I wanted to move our family, our two kids and my wife. And, you know, it was like, she won't have a job all of a sudden. We won't have her parents. My kids will be in a whole new place. And, you know, because of COVID, that opportunity is tabled, which is okay because ultimately, like I didn't have to make that choice, which it just sort of saved me from my own grief in that regard. But I think that it's just a vital part of, I don't know, I am a relationship guy anyway, but it has been really important for me to have a really strong partner, especially in a wife and a mom, because it's a tumultuous job, you know, being a freelance, like just not knowing. I mean, you know, there's months that go by occasionally, you know, every now and again that crickets. You don't know. Yeah. Yeah, crickets. You don't. Yeah. The empty, pit of your stomach that you get to feel every day with not knowing where your next paycheck is going to come in. And then, you know, then you get a job and then you've got to float, you know, yourself with in whatever way, whether that's savings or credit cards, which I've experienced both of like, great, I got this job. It's a good job. I'm not going to get paid for 4 months, you know? So yeah, it's been incredibly helpful. I constantly tell myself like, you wouldn't have the job you have if I didn't have her and her parents that, you know, really, really supportive, just very supportive of what I do.
Throughout your relationship, was there ever like any kind of like misunderstandings or like just,
oh yes.
I don't know if she's ever dated or a freelancer before, but I know just from personal experience, my wife didn't understand why on a Tuesday and Wednesday, why I was at home at 10 o'clock in the morning, my pajamas still. And I would explain to her that my weeks are binary. I'm either working or I'm not working. And yeah. When I'm not working, I'm actively looking for more work. But there was just this kind of disconnect because my wife, she's kind of a more 9-to-5 corporate person. So what was that like, I guess, for you guys when you were in, you know, in the early stages of the relationship?
Going back to like working in Chicago and then switching to New York, there was a very clear break of my wife telling me like, you are ready to be freelance. You know, I've taught myself what I believe is at least the sort of procedurally right way to do it. Someone had a business and I ended up doing a video for their business, which was just me and a buddy going out with a DSLR and a slider and a microphone, and then shooting some short comedy sketches. And then, so I think I was sort of slowly wading into the water in the work that I was doing while I still had the cushy job, and then and cushy being I had a safe staff job. It was not high paying at all, not cushy in the slightest, but it at least allowed me to entertain the idea of like, can I do this? What does it take to do it? And then after that, moving to New York, it was a, like, she was the one, actually, she was very encouraging. I go back to the support of like, I don't think I'd be here, because she was the one being like, you should do this. You can make more money doing this. If you do that, then maybe you'd be able to spend more time doing comedy, which is really what you want to focus on. And, you know, just sort of like the obvious conscience of the last, you know, my last 10 years of my career.
Sure. No, that's amazing to have someone that supports you like that and can kind of see through, you know, the superficial, like, you don't necessarily need to hold on to this quote unquote stable job.
Yeah,
because right. If you pursue what you want to do, you're going to ultimately be happier and more successful doing it. So that's amazing.
Beyond that, you know, to like look even farther back, I think like we've been together since I was 24. Wow. And I'm 37. So we've been together quite a long time, but also she saw me through all of those bits, and we've also seen each other through, like, she was fine during the crash of 2008-09. I lost my job and had to work 3 different jobs for 7 months just to be able to pay rent. And so we've both seen each other through those hard times, which I think they put the perspective on any other decisions that you have to make, where it's like, well, at least it's not that, you know, it's not as, this won't be as hard as that. You know, of something that it's changing careers or changing jobs or even having a baby, which adds another level of stress and anxiety to a career and a relationship.
Yeah. And that leads me to my next question. The pandemic happened last year and we're still kind of feeling the effects of it now. And I think we will be feeling it for a while. What was that like, I guess, having 2 kids and going through the pandemic? I know like all the calls dried up overnight for me, and I assume it was the same for you.
Well, because I do different stuff. So I was doing a lot of directing right before the pandemic, and then it just shifted to editing. And then as soon as the pandemic, like I didn't have 1 week of non-work last year.
Wow.
After the pandemic, January and February, we were pretty dry. I went out to LA for a gig for 3 weeks right before quarantine. And then when I came back, I was editing a show for Vice. And then I did a special with Adult Swim for a show that I co-produce and edit on called Joe Parra Talks With You. And then that was like 10 weeks of work. And then I went into some brand work that took me through the summer. And then I started doing work for the DNC, making, like, you know, response videos to issue-based politics stuff. And that was with the guy that I work with as a DP at The Late Show. And he was sort of moonlighting as like a producer for the Democratic committee. And then, you know, all the way into the fall, where like you and I did a bunch of work together in the fall and when production started to ramp up again. And so it was, I felt lucky to be able to pivot, but that pivot was, I think, mostly due to the fact that I already do that in my career, you know, where I, like I said earlier, I'm an editor to some people, and I'm a DP to some people, and some people I'm all of the above. And so I just sort of like put out some editing feelers at the beginning of that. And actually I didn't have to do much of it because a bunch of work came came to me to where like I was working too much. I think that I ended up working, my wife and I both, you know, we were saying, what did we do this year? It was like, well, we just stayed at home and worked. In terms of having two kids, we, you know, it was just nice to, I also, you know, all that being said, I understand how insensitive that might seem. So I hope that doesn't feel, if anyone's listening to this going like, wow, what an asshole. I just count myself lucky enough to have been able to do that. Where, and I've talked to a bunch of other editing friends that were all very, very busy. Two or three of my good buddies that I regularly keep up with in the community, we all said, you know, last year was like one of our banner years where financially, which is just not something that I ever expected. I mean, going into at every completion of every job last year, I never thought I was going to work for the rest of the year. And then sure enough, like it just was a really weird situation where I just, you know, the phone kept ringing, the emails kept coming in.
But that's in great. Terms I mean, of the fact that like, your ability to work in post-production also just kind of like helped because like for a person that works primarily on set, once pandemic happened, it just completely dried up from like overnight, March 13th, Friday the 13th. It just, every job just started canceling left and right. And by the end of the day, I was like zero. But when I was talking about all my post-production friends and friends who work, you know, not on set, they were like, it was, you know, booming all last year because every production company was trying to produce as much content with existing footage that they already had or creating stop motion stuff where it didn't require large groups of people on set. It was, you know, just a couple people in a small studio to be able to create this stuff. And it's funny how kind of it works out. But the fact that you had that really strong editing background really did help you out. So that's amazing.
Yeah, it was, I mean, like I said, I count myself really lucky. And I think that was, it's a rare thing, I think, to feel like, hey, this pandemic was great. But, you know, to go back into what you led with into the question was like, what was it like to have two kids? It was really hard to have two kids at home. But like I said, earlier, you know, we live out of the city in New Jersey and we're, you know, we have a yard and we live in a beach town. And so we were able to at least, it was just a lot of nice time at home. I mean, I said to my wife a bunch of times, like we've gotten so much time, more time at home than we would have gotten in 4 years with no quarantine, you know, with no pandemic. Like all of a sudden we are just spending more time, which I think like to me was like, oh yeah, this is sort of what life is supposed to be like. Yeah. What a nice time to be able to experience my kids. And then, you know, sure enough, we were working so much that, you know, we would be very thankful that our kids were asleep and then both have to work until 1 a.m. Wow. But I was really grateful that I am an optimist. I just looked at last year, even while it was happening, it's just like, man, we're very lucky. We're healthy and we both have a job. My wife is a brand manager for OxiClean. They had one of their best years ever last year because everyone just wanted a clean shit and they're all at home. I mean, going into that first week after March 13th, her boss was like, just want to let your whole team know, you know, our whole team, everybody's job is safe. Our 2009 was our best year we've ever had, you know, so we don't anticipate having to lay anyone off. And even just knowing that we were going to have her job was just a giant relief in and of itself. And then every job that came in from my perspective was sort of icing on the cake. And then, you know, was it hard to have two kids home that are our boys? We have two sons, 5 and 2, and our son was supposed to be in school. And that was a hard transition to like try and do virtual school. But this fall, our town is sort of forcing the school to stay open and just being really diligent about when cases happen that they're cleaning the school and they're isolating the people that were in direct contact. But they are really, we got an email from them last week saying like, we're one of the only schools in the state that has only, I think that we closed right before Christmas because there was like 5 cases in the school. But ultimately he's been in school with kids, which, you know, I've talked to some friends in Chicago that have kids and their kids haven't been in school since March. And I just think, God damn, that's a long time for the parents.
And for
it's a long
too.
Time for the kids. Yeah.
Be around your friends, run around and see each other.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, if we had older kids, I think that was another thing. Like I've talked, we were just grateful. I didn't have teenagers, you know, we have 5 and 2 and they want to be our best, you know, we're their gods. Yeah. And so they want us to be their best friends and we want to be their best friends. And so that's the perfect situation for quarantine, as I'm sure you feel the same.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, yeah, no matter how stressful of a day I'm having, my kid just kind of opens up my office door, wants me to run around and play with him, push him in his radio flyer. So it's definitely a much needed break, but it's great to have him around. And like you said, just being able to spend this much time with him, at first it was like a little bit daunting because I was like so stressed out. But then after a while, they're just like, I can't do anything about it. Let's just kind of run with this. And I can say like last year, had this pandemic not happened, I would have missed out on a lot of his, you know, kind of early milestones of like him talking and walking and all these things that I probably would have missed if I was on set for 12 hours a day. So there was a silver lining to this whole, chaotic event that's been going on.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. That's well put. I mean, I think it does, it puts it in perspective to me of, especially with everything else going on too, you know, politics and all the racial justice stuff last summer, like, which I get affected by the news pretty severely. So it was nice. My wife kept saying, like, just put down your phone, you know, like you can just enjoy these moments and just be with the boys because that'll be healthy for you to be away from that and just with them in whatever world that we're in.
Sure. So you mentioned that you're in Jersey also, and I know that this is like kind of like a New York filmmaker specific podcast, but a lot of our listeners and people that might be thinking of moving to New York, listen from Jersey and live in Jersey. What is that like? Like, what are the benefits of living in Jersey and kind of a little bit removed from the city, but also like working in the city? What's your commute like? What's it like kind of living and working in and around New York, but living in Jersey?
I really love it. I think like you can't really commute from where I live. I live in a town called Spring Lake, which is just south of Asbury Park. And it's like a quaint little beach town. It's pretty sleepy, except for in the summer it gets, you know, busy, but it's 45 to 50 miles just to like Manhattan. Lately, it's been really a breeze getting in, you know, in terms of the traffic. Coronavirus has definitely lightened the road load. You know, it was a weird thing not going in as much last year. So like, I don't mind the commute because ultimately I don't have to do it every day. And so I sort of treat it as like, well, look, my kids get the life of living down here, which is everything that I could ever want to give them, and enough space to have a yard. And we have a pool. And like I said, we're close to the beach. And so like their time living on this weird planet is pretty nice. While my commutes are, it's just nice me time to be honest. Like sometimes it is nice to get the time to yourself. And so I just get into podcasts and books. And when I have to commute regularly now, it totally varies. So if I'm coming in at traffic times, it's 2 hours on the way in. And if it's an off hour, generally like right now I can get into the city in an hour. I got to go in for an appointment tomorrow. It'll take me an hour to get into Manhattan. It depends on where I'm working. You know, a lot of shoots that I do have been in Brooklyn lately. It's generally a little harder to get to Brooklyn. If I'm bringing my camera package in, I have to drive anyway, you know, and I'd have to drive wherever I live. You know, I've got to plan a little farther ahead from a time and parking standpoint and traffic time. And ultimately at the end of a long day, it can be a pain to have to drive an hour. But even then, you know, if I'm shooting on the Upper West Side and my friends have to go back to Clinton Hill, I'll be home before them, you know, even if they're in the city, you know, using public transportation and I'm driving home. So to me, it's just the convenience of being in a place where we have space, my kids can have a nice life. And then my wife's job also is in Princeton. So it's, we both commute, you know, it was trying to find a place for both of us. And if we moved closer to the city, it would be us then paying for childcare and we pay her parents, but you know, it's like more of like a stipend for all the stuff that they do for us. We're like, here's your money. But we would have needed to find a place if we moved closer that would be good for my wife to go to the Princeton area. If we go north, it makes it a little better for me, but I don't go in and I get to be in my house. And like you said, in your PJs all day,
sure,
which is the best. And when I have to go in, it's a nice little treat because the restaurants suck where I live.
Okay.
but I do think like, I think it depends on what you need. You know, if you have a wife and kids, you don't necessarily need to be in the city. And it just depends on your jobs, really.
Yeah. My wife and I are in the same kind of boat. We're looking for a place to move to right now. And it's looking like it's going to be Jersey, but we're just trying to, we're trying to figure out what's going to work best for us in terms of space, in terms of price, in terms of commute. And those are kind of like the three big things. And also school zones, I guess, now for the kids as well.
But yeah, school zones.
These are variables that you have to kind of take into consideration.
The only other factor about living where I live is that there is no public transportation that gets you into the city quickly.
Okay.
The train lines, because they're old, and there's no express from down here. And so the train straight up takes 2 hours to get into the city. So there's no way to make that a viable commuting solution.
Yeah, sure.
We get a bad rap down here, but one of my wife's uncles, one time I've met him, and I had an interesting view of New Jersey, though my dad lived here when I was in high school for a little bit. And I had the same opinion. It was just like, ugh, New Jersey. But one of the first times I met my wife's uncle, I said, New Jersey gets a bad rap. And he said, yeah, we like it that way. Keeps people out. okay. Yeah. And I feel the same way. I feel the same exact way now. Yeah.
You having been an outsider from Chicago, moving to New York, you kind of moved here and had to kind of start planning new routes. And in doing so as a freelancer and as a person new to a new city, it's all about networking. And, I think nowadays, a lot of the kids these days, they have Facebook, which is an amazing tool for networking. You can kind of join all these groups and, different forums to talk shop and stuff like that. But when you first moved here and even today, can you recommend, or do you know of any in-person networking things that people can kind of go and meet each other and kind of talk shop and
interesting. I mean, each other? For me, that was comedy shows. Because of COVID right now, I don't know any.
Yeah, right now it's a weird time.
But it is a weird time. And I think the theater scene and the independent theater and that kind of, that level of stuff, I think it depends on what you want to do and where you want to be working. In terms of straight networking groups are great. And I've been to a couple events like that since I've been in New York and found them generally, I went to a couple with some buddies. The biggest thing that I've experienced that has been helpful is just meeting like-minded people and making stuff and then putting that stuff out. And I've found that has been the biggest return on my investment for just even opening new doors to other work and other opportunities. We just want to make this dumb thing and let's see what happens. And, I've done plenty of them that have gotten me no attention. And then a bunch that have gotten a little more, that they return in an interesting way or they just open some doors. And I think that to me, like I said, when I got to New York, I spent time contacting people and trying to say, hey, I want to do this. How do I do this? And the overwhelming thing I heard from people that were sort of ahead of me in their career path was just make stuff, just make as much stuff as you can. And so I took that to heart and then I did that. And I got to be honest, it's paying off. One, it pays off to me just in learning, because I'm a bit of a perfectionist. I'm not really satisfied with stuff. But I think if you can find someone that you like to work with and you can both agree that you're going to make each other better and that you're going to serve the idea and the project, that if you come into it with ideas, hopefully the group of people that you're with, you're going to get something out of that. Even if that's a lesson on how not to do something, that's also a lesson.
Sure.
Hey, here's how we failed in this one. I've got lots of short films that I've never put out because I feel like I failed in executing the idea, or I got distracted by something that I thought was important that might not have been, and didn't get enough footage of whatever. I don't know. I think making stuff, putting it out, I think that is to me the best way to, because it's also it's not calling card is a dumb term, but I do think that if you put stuff out, people see you as someone who puts stuff out and makes stuff. And I think that that's helped me be a doer and have people see me as a doer as opposed to a talker. Because I've been a talker. I've been a talker for plenty of projects that I've either spent a lot of time talking about and not doing, or a little afraid of the idea, or afraid of trying to like get something off the ground, or you're just with people that can't get it together and they can't decide to start the actual project. So yeah, I feel like that's what I'd say about that, as opposed to networking, because those things are going to help you network, even if it's one more person. I was telling my wife this a little while ago. There's literally one project that I decided to do when I got here to New York that connected me to so many people. And it was just doing that one project led me to this one person who opened, not opened doors, but allowed me to be inside a different room. And that was because I was like, yeah, that seems like fun. I'm going to do that. And we did it and had a good time.
And that was a personal project you were talking about?
That was just a comedy project. And it led me to doing bigger, you know, it continually led me down the path of doing bigger comedy projects and bigger and more widely exposed and higher budget. And, you know, eventually I think that it was one of those is like, I was working on a short film and then a year later I'm like, okay, I'm doing a comedy pilot for Comedy Central. And that, you know, that's produced by a, you know, big Hollywood director that like, it was all just doing stuff, less talking, more doing. I feel like that's sort of my motto.
Sure.
Well, yeah, I don't have a motto.
Like I've seen a bunch of your work on your website, whitconway.com. There's like a bunch of examples of like the short films and like projects that you've worked on. And a lot of it's like, it's hilarious. One, it's really funny. It reminds me a lot of like classic SNL absurdist skits. And you work with a lot of the same people and stuff like that. What kind of inspired you to start creating content in the comedy? Do you have like any kind of filmmakers that you looked up to or shows that you really liked?
Yeah. I mean, I think I like, ever since I was at Indiana University, I did a sketch comedy class, like I talked about a little bit earlier. And that really led me into the idea that like, hey, comedy is really fun and funny. And I have never, and then doing the, you know, improv class and schools in Chicago was an aspect of that as well. You know, I like to laugh and I think that it's the best way to go through life. And so it's fun to try and make people laugh. It's very rewarding to have people tell you that they thought something was very funny. So thank you, Tom. Yeah. But I think that in terms of my upbringing in comedy, yes, my mom, when I was 10, I'm pretty sure, you know, 10 or 11, put on Monty Python, Holy Grail, gave me Blazing Saddles and Spaceballs. And I used to come home from school and I would watch Monty Python, Holy Grail. I would watch Wayne's World. I would watch Blazing Saddles pretty much on repeat to where I can, Blues Brothers was in there, to where I can recite them. I mean, I pretty close to, you know, I would say I'm at about, at this point, as I haven't seen many of them. I watched Holy Grail and Wayne's World pretty recently. I haven't seen Blazing Saddles in a little bit, but I can straight up recite them. I mean, my wife won't watch them with me because I can't stop talking through them because they just hit my 13-year-old self of the kid who came back from school and put them on every day and watched them. And then I fell in love with comedy pretty early. I was a performer. Like I said, I was a musician and I was always interested in comedy and it was something that I always wanted to do. And even when I was doing improv in Chicago, you know, I never felt like I was the best performer, but I loved doing it and I loved being right next to it almost. And so when I was trying to, I think when I started doing comedy filmmaking, it really was one of those things like I can feel like I can put a stamp on this and I have some idea of how I would do that. And I think that that's the biggest, you know, that would be what I would consider my perspective. It's just that I like comedy a lot and it's a fun way to exist, you know, even if you're agonizing over like I work with some people that we agonize over comedy and it's fun to do. It can be exhausting, but it's the thought that goes into it that makes it special, I think. So yeah, was that the question?
Yeah. Well, so like for me, like I know like a lot of the comedy is in the editing. Like, do you edit the projects that you direct and write as well? Or do you hand that off to somebody else for them to be able to edit or what?
It's about, I mean, it's probably 95 to 9% of I edit the majority of stuff that I direct,
sure.
unless that's for a show or something like that, or like a bigger opportunity and they can afford a, you know, and there's like a bigger pipeline of process. Sure. So yeah, it's about for the most part, I do edit what I direct.
And with the projects, your personal projects, do you do them for yourself or do you kind of enter them into festivals? Like what's the process after you completed the projects?
I'm admittedly pretty bad at distribution, but for the most part, the people that I work with, we just really care about getting stuff out, that it's more of a proof of concept of, hey, hopefully someone will eventually pay us to make a show, sure. which I've been a part of, and I've been very close to happening at, in terms of like a higher capacity as a director. You know, I've had some projects that pitched and that, you know, haven't gone, but to me, again, it goes back to doing stuff. And there's a lot of festivals out there that I think you can get a lot out of. But if you're doing like a sketchy based comedy thing, I don't think there's a reason to sit on that and wait for a judge of a festival to tell you this is funny or not.
Right.
I really believe that the best place for those is just in the eyes of the people that are going to watch it, which the best way you can do is just get it out to the onto the internet as sort of as fast as possible. I think like a lot of times I work backwards from like a date of, hey, we want this out. Like I just created one for Christmas. You know, we did one that's it's called the Mayo Bubble. And I did that with John Reynolds and Carmen Christopher. And we made that in about 7 days, where it was like, John had this funny idea. He and I beat it out in terms of what we were going to shoot, where we were going to shoot it, and sort of what the ideas were. And then I know you said it's all in the editing. To me, it's a lot in the editing. It's about what you want to leave in to the piece, but it's also, you know, having amazing performers like John and Carmen, yeah. who one, they just know each other really well too. Like that's, we all know each other really well. We've all worked together for years, and that helps us all work very quickly, because we shot it in about 6 hours. And I know that when I turn the camera on, they're going to be funny, you know, because we're just comfortable with being together in that capacity. And so because of that, it's not like it's a safe bet, but it is helpful to have people that you feel like are really funny people. So I think like I've been on the other end of it where I'm like, I'm not sure about this idea. But I said yes to it. And so what do you do then? You just try and make it as good as possible. And I think then it truly is really in the edit of how do you make the strongest piece with maybe, I don't want to say, you know, subpar pieces, but with where you might be compensating for a performance, for example, which I think, you know, that could happen at any capacity. I'm sure that happens in films all the time. You know, you cast someone and they might not be performing at the level that you want them to be performing at, or they're going to do something that you didn't anticipate. I think like, does that answer your question?
Yeah, I think it does. So like, I know that like in pretty much most of the videos that I've seen, like you guys all work together on a bunch of different shoots. Do you guys all write, direct together, or are you mostly the director and somebody else writes it and then they act?
Yeah.
How does that workflow go?
I think the guy that I work mostly with is Carmen Christopher, and he's, you know, we generally work on, it's a bit of a co on everything, and I do a lot of the production, but we're planning the whole thing out together. We just did one for the like last year called Single Dad. And that to me was an exercise in what can we do during coronavirus that doesn't feel like it's going to be tied to coronavirus, because there's going to be no crew. There's going to be no, you know, we made it in the middle of the summer when things were like fully shut down, and, sure. you know, he got tested, but it was like, what do we have at our disposal? Well, thank goodness I live outside of the city and have two kids. We'll make you their dad and we'll improvise for a couple of days. We wrote an outline and then we started shooting, and the boys just didn't want to do what I wanted them to do. And it was the first, you know, real foray into being a stage parent and also a director of kids. Sure. Which I've worked with plenty of kids in the past, but the working with your children is a bit of a different bag.
Yeah.
But really, that was like, we're just making the thing together, and we're entertaining ourselves. I think that's something that I tell people that contact me to ask, like, well, what should I do about this thing? Well, I think if you feel like, you know, when something is subpar for your own taste, and so if you continually push how to make something as good as you can make it with what you have available, people will see that. To me, that's like the love you put into something. It's just spending the time to make something that you really put a lot of yourself into, and having it be my kids, that was a really sensitive thing. I want them to come across really well. I want them to make people laugh. I want them to appear, you know, the twist of the guy doesn't like being a dad too much, you know, to the point of at one point he says like, this is not my favorite of my sons, you know, we're on a shot of my older son. I think to me that it's entertain yourself and try and do something that you can, that's as original as possible. And really, I mean, less original, more entertains you, makes you feel something. So that's sort of, I generally am behind the camera. And so I am doing the directing. I get to trust my friends in front of the camera to do the stuff. And then I just know, because I'm editing it as well, I know when I have what I need to make the moment happen in the edit, and they trust me to know that. So it's a bit of like a revolving door of like, because we'll stop a take, then check in. Okay, well, we got this moment, but we didn't get that. Okay, let me change angles and I'm going to push in and we'll do this again. But it's really just about these couple lines. So we can just jump right into that. We don't have to do the whole scene. And then great. Okay, moving on to the next, you know, moving on to the next scene. Working in a really small crew capacity like that, where I am literally doing all of the production and it's just two people, you know, that was just me and Carmen, for example.
Okay.
You have to rely, it is like, you have to collaborate, I think, when I'm working on something bigger. I just like to trust people that they're doing service to the piece. Like when I have a department of people that are available to me to make those kind of decisions and stuff, it's really fun to, like you said earlier, like go back to, I get to trust this person to do their job and be able to guide them because I've sort of been, you know, partly in their shoes before.
So one thing that I noticed is like a lot of the shoots that you do, like the personal projects that you do, like they're kind of in live locations. You know, you're shooting in Central Park, you're shooting underneath the Brooklyn Bridge, you're shooting on city streets. Because these are such like nimble, like personal projects, do you guys go through the normal pipelines of applying for permits and all that stuff? Or do you guys just kind of do the run and gun kind of thing where it's small, no tripod, and just kind of get what we can because it's comedy. It doesn't have to look like Citizen Kane. It's just going to be really character driven.
I think it depends on the budget. And you know, there's a film I made called Season's Greetings with a late night with Seth Meyers writer named Ben Wehrheit, you know,
which is amazing. That was by the way. I was dying laughing.
Thanks for that. It's an absurd premise that turns some people off, but I am proud of how we made it. And so it was a fun one to make. That is the kind of thing where like there was a budget needed for that. And so, you know, going through the permitting process for the buildings that we ended up shooting, because it was all based on lobbies and doormen. And so we had to have like four different like high-rise building lobbies, not something you can get for free. Whereas like doing something, and I do put down the tripod, you know, doing something like in Central Park. I actually like for Mayo Bubble, which is in Central Park, don't tell the film office, please.
Yeah.
I contacted them and they were like, it's going to take like 15 days. Ooh. And I was like, okay, great. I'll be back in touch. And then we shot the next day.
Sure.
And it was one of those things, like it just happened fast. It was a Christmas thing, you know, and we couldn't wait. I think that goes back to me, like part of my justification of being able to do that and being okay stealing locations like that is because I'm not really always like, we're not selling that piece. So we're just making it to make people laugh.
Sure.
Hopefully I get some work out of it because someone sees that and they go, that was really great. You know, we shot in front of the 30 Rock Christmas tree while the Saks Fifth Avenue light show is playing.
Yeah.
We did not talk to Saks Fifth Avenue or 30 Rock because the idea was so flimsy and silly, it just doesn't warrant paying any money for it. And I think I'm a big proponent of asking forgiveness instead of permission 100%. when I have to, you know. Now, if we need a coffee shop or if we need a lobby, like I said, like if there's a bigger ask for location, I do generally do, you know, I wouldn't walk into a coffee shop and steal that location. But anywhere in New York City that's on the train, in a park, you know, on the street, out in front of people's houses, I feel the license to be able to make that, mostly because, you know, I'm not needing a location release to like distribute this through someone that they're like, you better have all your I's dotted and T's crossed.
Sure.
That goes right back to me wanting to just get it out there for people to see it. It's just about how fast people can see it and not how careful we are being with the production. Sure. Unless we have to be, you know, if there was a need, we had to like close a street or do something like that. I've had plenty of people approach me for comedy videos that have that kind of ideas, but we talk about how much money it costs. And then comedians who generally don't have money, I say, how can we make this idea translate to a different idea that costs no money? Sure. You know,
yeah.
Do we really need this thing to happen? Can we go without that or pivot the idea so that it can take place in an apartment building in this character's, you know, bathroom, or if it's in a hallway and we just, you know, use your building and steal that or whatever it is. So, you know, I'm not doing too much film festival submission where they're like, make sure that you
have all your releases and
yeah, exactly.
Sure. Yeah. Okay.
I don't know if that's right or not, but that's how I've been doing it.
Well, yeah, I think just the aesthetic like lends itself to the comedy because it doesn't seem overly produced. It does seem like something that anyone could do if you pick up like a, you know, like a basic camera and you have talented people that can kind of like carry the piece and a funny enough premise. You can shoot it kind of on the go and not necessarily do everything quote unquote properly. Because I work in film production, I know how complicated and
yes,
you know, slow this machine is to get this content made. But when you get two really good performers in front of a camera with like a good script and they can kind of like play off each other, it's amazing to see what kind of magic they can make with close to no budget. Sometimes even just kind of running around with like a camera, a microphone and two actors, you get magic on the screen. So it's cool. So I also saw that like you did a SNL work during this pandemic, and you know, SNL, we kind of all grew up watching SNL here in New York, where it's like people come together on this, you know, soundstage in Manhattan and they record all this content. But during the pandemic, that wasn't possible. Like, a lot of the people were acting from home via Zoom and stuff like that. Tell me, what was that like? What was that whole process like? Cause to me, it was incredible to see how seamlessly they transitioned from doing it traditionally to doing it through Zoom. And what was that like on your end, just having worked on both sides of the,
I spent a couple seasons in the film unit as an assistant editor, and then occasionally an editor. I've gotten to edit a bunch of pieces for the air, but it's probably just about a handful. With the quarantine, so I was in Los Angeles. I did a directing trial at Jimmy Kimmel's show. That was what I was like there. You know, that was the possibility of like me moving to LA, which was like, you know, now that job has put a pin in it. That was so I had stopped working at SNL for that. So I dipped out sort of midway through last season. And then after I got back from that and quarantine started to happen, I didn't do the first bunch of shows, but I just did the final show, the at-home season finale. It was nice because we had more time. Generally, the film unit is such that like in the post department, the producers and the directors over there are, and everybody really, I mean, it's just such a high stakes and high quality operation. Generally what the schedule is like a Wednesday night, they lock the scripts. Thursday night, they're doing scouting and all the prep for the design. So like sets are being built, costumes are being created. Wednesday night, they lock the script that they're shooting on Friday. So then they do all prep on Thursday, then they shoot on Friday. And then the editors and the post team have all of Friday, depending on when it wraps, which they stagger the shoots for the cast schedules because they have three different units over there. And then the editors work all of Friday until they have basically a full piece that they can show the directors. And then they work and edit all of Saturday, play the piece for the dress rehearsal at 9 on Saturday night. And then coming out of that, they make changes for the live show at 11:35. It's a really furious process. And generally the editors only have 30 hours or under to finish these film pieces, some of which are so elaborate and big that it's just fucking amazing that they get made. Sure. What the pandemic did was made the entire week the production schedule. So I think I did a Zoom church with Keenan for Oz Rodriguez, who directed it. I got that footage on like Tuesday. So we just had more time, and it was a giant, like doing a Zoom. The bit was that, you know, you're at church with Zoom. So there's hundreds of people, but we wanted to see as many people on screen at once. And so, you know, just to build a grid of 150 Zoom screens with, you know, as many unique video frames as possible is a challenge in and of itself. But having the extra time there was nice. And it was ultimately like, it felt more relaxed than anything. I have friends over there now, and, you know, I've been in touch with a couple of them, and they really a very stressful, the added, because they're doing everything in person now, like there's an added quarantine, COVID safe level of stress. It's already a really stressful place, and you're creating under this very stressful umbrella. But I mean, they're doing a great job. You know, I can't believe they did five shows, I think, in a row in the fall before the election. And that is a giant feat. Just the amount of work that it takes to do that show every week is a testament to the crew that makes it happen. And so they should all be very proud of themselves.
Okay. So going back to the stuff that you've been making as well, a lot of it's like a short form content. Do you have any like a desire to kind of make longer form content, like a feature, or do you like sticking to like the shorter form content?
It's funny, 'cause like, you know, it's short, but it's not, I think the stuff that I've been making has been graduating from like the 2 to 3 minutes, really sketchy stuff, to like the 10 to 15 minute shorts. Seasons Greetings was about 15 minutes. Single Dad is, I think, 12 and a half, 13. Mayo Bubble is 9, almost 10. That's definitely, I think it's nice to exercise the ability to tell a longer story. And that's sort of what I'm experiencing. I think I go back to, and you know, this might be helpful. I feel like I knew a bunch of people when I was right out of college that I saw try and make feature films, and they failed so spectacularly. Yep. It turned me off to try and do that before I'm ready to do it. So I really tried to focus on, hey, I think I can get really good at making short stuff. Also, short stuff allows me to experiment and try different stuff on every shoot that I have. It's ultimately lower stakes, but you get to experiment and get that same sort of reward of completing something and getting it out the door. You also have that much more immediate feedback. And I definitely want to move into the longer form, I guess, content is the right thing to say. In the meantime, you know, I think working in short form really helped me hone my ability to understand comedy and understand the type of comedy that I like to make. And then also for each idea, you know, what it is that needs to happen. But yes, I'm working with a friend right now who self-shot a feature. Wow. And I'm helping produce and edit it. And we're in the process of that. I am writing some longer form stuff that, you know, hopefully I'll get to make eventually. We'll see.
All right. So I'm kind of coming to a close here. I had just a couple of questions that I wanted to ask you for fun. So we've all worked on a bunch of indie projects, and I wanted to know, like, have you ever been like dicked over on a job? Have you ever done like a job and just either not been paid or just mistreated? And how did you deal with it?
Last week I had a producer tell me that I did a job for an agency. I don't want to name names. I should name names, but I won't. And they said, well, you know, essentially what happened was I did a bunch of work where we created a custom motion graphics video, me and one of my motion graphics buddies. And it was really just one of those things, like it's a small enough budget, but it's for an event. It's nothing like really special, but it was a ton of work. You know, custom motion graphics video that's 4 minutes long is not a short piece. Wrapped up in that was like a bunch of like smaller motion graphics work. The client changed the goalposts on me, you know, pretty late in the game. And then when I was invoicing, decided to say like, yeah, by the way, I don't want to pay for that stuff. Wow. And so, you know, what do I do? How did I react? I go back and I get all the approvals in an email. I put them all in and say, you know, here's this, here's what you need to pay me, that we agreed upon. And, you know, here's you approving this work. And I don't know, I try and not get emotional about it because I think it goes back to, you're going to cross people in the industry that, and I'm sure you've had this experience, that you say at the end of a job, I'm never going to work with that person again.
Yeah.
You know, that was my experience with that job, and I won't ever work with that person again. And I, you know, I don't know. It's like, I think that there are some people in this job that in this industry, they believe it's their job to try and get people that are working really hard for them to pay, to be paid as little as possible. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you feel the same way,
yeah.
You know, like there are, yeah, right. There are some people that are going, even after you've agreed, they will try and dick you over. And I think that it's just a warning of how they're going to treat you in the future. If you have the ability to turn down the work from them in the future, you know, do that, or go in heads up and either head it off at the pass and say, you need deposits up front. You need to be, you know, paid in advance, in some capacity, or understand they're going to do the same thing again, which again, I've done the same. I think you and I both know, someone that shall remain unnamed.
Sure.
that always tries to get the lowest number out of you.
Yeah.
It's an interesting thing. Moving from the aspect of where I'm being hired to where I'm doing more hiring and sort of filling out teams, I'm always so desperate to give everyone as much money as possible. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I want to try and make people feel really good about the job. And so, you know, the difference for a PA of 350 and 450 is gigantic.
Sure.
The difference for an AC of getting $400 and $600 a day is gigantic. And if we're working on a long-term project, maybe not doable. If you're working on a 20-day project, mm-hmm. that adds up, that extra $200. But I think, like, if you're working on a 2-day project, you know, they're going to be so much happier. And you're going to be doing something for them that makes them happier. Sure. And I think that, to me, goes back to being a good boss, you know, being and caring about the people that are going to make you and your work look good.
Yeah.
When I have to hire people for my independent comedy stuff, I always try and pay them a full rate. You know, that's what, when I talk to comedians that they want to do this, you know, XYZ, I say, well, we need to hire a crew for this part. You know, and they say, well, how much is that going to cost? And I say, well, you know, the crew, like the gaffer's not going to benefit from this sketch video coming out. Mm-hmm. He's not probably going to get called. So we should pay them. And if I heard a couple of years ago, like if your crew isn't going to benefit from the release of the piece, you should be paying them and paying them in as full of a rate as you possibly can. Sure. And to me, that's sort of how I try and operate.
I have got one more main question that I wanted to ask you. In all the years that you've done this, I'm sure you've had some difficult times on set. What has been like the biggest nightmare you ever had to deal with?
I think the scariest moment that I've had was recently. I got hired to direct a segment for the Emmys last year, this past fall. So September we were shooting. I got, I think it was 8 days, 8 days of like, we got to book a crew, COVID test everyone, shoot, and then do post. I was doing the post. So I wasn't as worried about that, but yeah. It was just a really furious turnaround. You were involved. Yeah. on that shoot, I was not DPing, but I was producing it. We were using my camera package. I own a Red Epic. The AC that I hired that did the checkout, it was a union gig. So I had to work with a lot of union people that I don't have that great of a network of yet. Mm-hmm. And the union AC that was hired assumed that I had a Red PL mount for the Canon servo lens we were using. And I do not. It's on my list of things to spend $2,000 on.
Wow.
Well, no, there's, I think there's a wooden camera one that's like 400, but I just haven't bought that piece of equipment yet. And we showed up at the shoot and he goes, where's the PL mount? Just, I don't have a PL mount. And we're shooting in not upstate New York. We're shooting about an hour and a half north of the city with David Letterman for an Emmy segment, which just like, you know, your heart and your stomach fall out of your body.
Sure.
And I called Derek Zimmerman at Cinema Vision, who's the rental house that I love to use. So if you guys are out there and listening and you want to give a really nice rental house some business, please use Cinema Vision in New York. They're fantastic. Derek messengered a PL mount. We shot a rehearsal with my still glass that I own and had on my camera that I hadn't disassembled, which I had thought about the day before. Like, I'm gonna disassemble my camera, make it look real spiffy.
Yeah.
And I just never had the time to do it the day before, thank God. So I had my lenses.
Yeah.
And, you know, we shot a rehearsal with, there's like a car stunt that we had to do. And so we shot a bunch of that. And then Derek messengered it up. And thank God we had the padding of like 4 hours before the talent, Mr. David Letterman, showed up. And it got here maybe, I think, like 25 minutes before we were rolling with it with Dave. So that was pretty harrowing. And one of those moments of like, if nobody's, I think I can get away with this if I absolutely have to, but it's going to kill me.
Sure.
And ended up not having to. So it was thanks to Derek Zimmerman at Cinema Vision and his fast messenger services.
Sure.
That was the shoot was saved.
How important is it to have relationships with specific rental houses when you work in production?
I am pretty technically minded, but I'm not an AC. I know that, you know, I know that like when I show up, like I'm not calibrating a wireless for lenses. I know how to set up wireless video signal stuff, but I absolutely can't stand, you know, it's like, I don't own that equipment. And so relying on the people to give you what you need is really good. Relying on your staff that you hire to do that is really smart as well. So I try and just surround myself with the best assistants and gaffers that I possibly can so that they can tell me the right way to do stuff. And I think that goes back to me feeling like a little inadequate in my own self-teaching, right? So like, I think this goes back to me going like, well, I know how to do it the way I would do it, but I never went to film school where I had a fucking techno crane available
right.
for a shoot, you know? So I don't really know how to use a techno crane. So I just try and rely on the people that do really understand that stuff, you know? And then I think your whole career is relationships, really. The nicer you can be to people, the best partner that you can be for everyone. Even in that, I like to tell that story about Cinema Vision because I like trying to give them more business because they did me a solid and they really treated me with a lot of respect. And I've only been treated with respect there. And I've rented at most of the rental houses, what I feel like, you know, many of the rental houses in New York, they're the friendliest to me as far as I've used. And I've used some other ones that I won't name where stuff comes, you know, it doesn't feel like it's been checked or whatever. And you know, it all is in relationship with, are you picking it up? Are you doing a checkout? Or I think my experience there runs the gamut from like, I'm just getting handed a case, hopefully everything's in it, yeah. Or I'm having an assistant spend, you know, an afternoon there and we get to talk about, hey, would we use this? Maybe we should use this. Maybe we should grab this. I think it's important. I think more than anything, it's the relationship with other people that's the most important. It doesn't have to be Cinema Vision or a rental house, more that it's the people that are helping you make the thing you're trying to make.
100%.
Just like you, Tom.
Yeah. And it's also just like, it's such a small industry where if you treat someone well, like, you know, it comes back to you. And same thing with like a rental house is like when you return equipment properly and you pack things away and you, for me, at least when I build relationships with these rental houses, I know that if something goes wrong on set, I can call and talk to someone specifically that knows me and I know them and kind of walk me through an issue on set. Or, you know, God forbid, if I leave a lens in New York, they can kind of bring it out to me as fast as possible. So
yeah,
it goes a long way to try to build these like strong relationships with reputable sources. And
yeah, I think you're exactly right there. And they're going to make your job easier if you let them, you know.
How do people find you from home? Like if people want to try to find Whit Conway, are you on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter?
Not on Facebook, Instagram. My handle is Whitney Christopher and Twitter, I'm Whit Conway. That's really the only place that I post stuff. And then my website, whitconway.com.
Okay.
WHITCONWAY.
Cool.
And you know, I'd be happy to hear from anyone if they want it, if they want any more advice, or it seems like this is the longest I've ever talked in my whole life. So hopefully they feel sufficiently talked at. But if anyone wants to reach out, my email's on my website, and I'd be happy to hear from you. And hopefully we can work together soon, both them and also Tom, you and me. Hopefully we'll be back on set soon.
I miss you.
It's dry January though.
That's right, right. Hopefully in a month or two when things pick up, we'll see each other.
Okay, so that just about wraps up today's interview. I hope you all found this episode helpful and you managed to take away some really useful nuggets of knowledge from today's speaker. If you want to hear other filmmakers trade some of their war stories of what it takes to live and work in the film industry here in New York, click the subscribe button. I think a lot of you will recognize some of those voices as old friends, some colleagues who are going through similar career and life experiences and can offer advice on what's worked for them throughout their careers, what hasn't, and just generally get a pulse on the business. Also, if you enjoyed today's episode, leave me some feedback, please, so I know what's working, what isn't. I'm sure you guys have some great questions and ideas on how to make this podcast awesome, so please drop me a comment in iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or wherever you're tuning in from. Lastly, if you'd like to learn more about the show, the guests who were on the show, or just learn some really useful resources that are available to NYC filmmakers, many of which are free, visit our website at nycvideopodcast.com. I'm Tom Chavez of MasterShot Films. This is the NYC Video Podcast, and thanks for tuning in. Stay safe, keep shooting, and I will see you on set.